The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
It's hump day. So why does it feel like frump day? Are you barely making it through the week with no energy to speak of? That's all about to change. Welcome to Transforming Health with Brad King. Get ready to live with the vitality, youthfulness, and abundant energy you've always dreamed of. Now, here's your host, Brad.
Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of Transforming Health with Brad King. I'm your host, and this is, as you know, the platform that we at least hope helps change lives one body at a time. You know, that's why we bring you the incredible guests we do every single week and some of the most incredible topics. And today's topic is one that is definitely overdue. You're going to find it a little, maybe a lot controversial, but this fellow that we're about to bring on, he's done his homework. He also does a lot of lecturing, and he's a professor at one of the top universities. So let me ask you a couple of questions before we get to the topic of the show, and this will just kind of give you an idea of what we're going to be talking about today. How many of you would remember what it would be like to be young? Now, when I say that, I'm of course, talking about in the biological sense, as opposed to the chronological sense, because we now know we don't age in a linear fashion. We age by how old our cells really are. So we really do have an impact in how old we want to be, at least to a certain degree. So if your memory is already starting to fade, well, allow me to remind you, you know, when you were young, it meant popping out of bed without hearing a pop, or being young meant running for the school bus without needing a few cups of coffee to get you there. Being young meant jumping on the monkey bars in the local park instead of thinking twice about the numerous injuries that would probably occur if you did it now. And being young meant sleeping through the night without getting up multiple times to try to empty those last few drops of urine from your bladder. You did not do any of those things when you were young on a biological level. So in other words, when you were young, you didn't worry about lost neurons or sore, achy joints or low energy. For that matter, you also didn't worry about high cholesterol or prostate disorders or bladder problems or bone problems, and therefore you didn't need the various tests that go along with these things. So why is that? Well, because for the most part, you were expected to be normal and healthy. So there was no point to subject you to these, you know, so-called routine medical tests. So why is it expected when you get a little older? Well, it's more accepted. It's the accepted belief that every older person must be suffering from some illness or disease, or is there another reason that could just be a little more sinister than just expecting us to have something going wrong when we get older? What if most of us were being asked to undergo medical testing for no other reason than to turn us into yet another consumer of the medical and pharmaceutical industry? And didn't someone once say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it? Well, there's another saying, if you look hard enough, you will find something. The fact is, doctors often order tests and recommend drugs or procedures when they shouldn't, sometimes even when they know they shouldn't. In fact, nearly half of primary care physicians say their own patients get too much medical care. And according to a survey published in 2011 by researchers at Dartmouth College, it's believed that up to 30% of healthcare is unnecessary. It may be a lot more than that. Today on Transforming Health, if we are supposed to be in search of wellness, then why, oh, why do we work so hard to seek sickness? Well, today's guest is a pharmaceutical policy researcher at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, Canada. He studies how clinical research, information, and experience on prescription drugs get communicated to policymakers and consumers alike. So please welcome the best-selling author of Seeking Sickness, Medical Screening, and the Miss guided hunt for disease. We have the one and only Alan Castles with us. Alan, welcome to Transforming Health.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Alan, first off, I want to congratulate you on blowing the proverbial whistle on the medical establishment when it comes to possible dangers that are associated with many of the medical tests we have, you know, come to believe that are absolutely necessary rather than an option in our life. So I thought we'd start off by you explaining, you know, first of all, what is Seeking Sickness all about and what really motivated you to write it?
The book is, in a nutshell, the book is about all the medical screening tests that were presented as, you know, as we make our way through life. And really the issue being most people would believe that they can't be hurt by a screening test. Yes, they're only looking for signs of disease such as high cholesterol or low bone density or looking for cancerous cells in my prostate. How could I be hurt by that? And, you know, the more I looked into medical screening, the more I realized that statistically, people are much more likely to be injured and to be hurt by a lot of screening tests than to be helped. And so I thought this was a worthy subject of writing about because, you know, a lot of people and, you know, even physicians are somewhat bamboozled by the proposed benefits of screening and really don't understand very well the potential harms.
So how are these medical doctors bamboozled then? I mean, you know, they're the ones, once again, that are ordering these tests. They're the ones that are talking to their patients about the tests. Shouldn't they be up on any of the potential risks about the tests? Isn't it really their responsibility or is it our responsibility?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of them are getting more aware of the risks. Certainly we've seen a bit of a sea change when it comes to things like but probably the best example would be prostate screening. So 10 years ago, physicians, if you turn 50 years old, you're male, your physician would automatically say you need to get a PSA test. And this is a test that is just a simple blood test. So you think, you know, how could that hurt me? Well, if they find in that blood sample a high level of a particular antigen called the prostate-specific antigen, if they find that in your blood, they will say, you know, Alan, you are at high risk of having prostate cancer. They may not tell you that, you know, there's lots of things that could elevate your PSA level, including having had sex the night before or having an infection or having some other perhaps prostate conditions, though it may not be prostate cancer. So but what happens once the test is done, you're led down. There is a sequence of events that typically unfolds where they would send you for a biopsy, which involves inserting very fine needles into your prostate to extract tissue samples. They would put those under a microscope, and they might say, yes, we found some prostate cancer cells, and we have to do something about it. So, you know, you might say, well, boy, that's going to save my life. Why wouldn't I do that?
Mm-hmm.
But what you're not told is that if you live long enough, all of us are going to develop some abnormalities in our prostates. Most of us will. You know, if you're in the age of, if you get up to 50, 60, 70 years old, more than half of the men at that age are going to have unusual scores on a prostate screening test. That doesn't mean they've got cancer, and certainly doesn't mean that they've got the kind of cancer that's going to kill them. You know, prostate
right.
cancer is and can be lethal, but only about 3% of men will ever die from prostate cancer.
This is the interesting thing, and you talk about this in your book where, you know, a lot of people aren't told these things. Like, for instance, my father had prostate cancer. As you said, I mean, one in six men are expected to experience prostate cancer, but it is one of the slowest, if not the slowest of all cancers, and the prostate tissue is very, very strong tissue. So very, very few, like you said, maybe up to 3% will ever experience
right.
The metastasis or the spreading of that cancer. So many of us die from many other diseases other
yeah.
than the cancer. So why would we subject ourselves to, you know, the horrible treatments that ensue because of a positive test?
Right. In fact, you know, physicians are fond of saying that, or some of them anyways, will say, most men will die with prostate cancer, but not because of it.
Right. And then you talk to some of the men that have actually gone through some of these treatments. And, you know, as you know, one of the treatments is what we would call a deprivation of the hormone that doctors still believe is causing prostate cancer, which has absolutely nothing to do with it. It's called testosterone or dihydrotestosterone. So what they're still doing is medically castrating men by stopping their testosterone production. And it's almost like an estrogen therapy. But the point is, I've had men that have come up to me and told me the treatment is much worse than the actual disease. So, what do you say about that?
Well, I absolutely. You know, from my study of the research, I absolutely agree. In fact, one researcher a man named Dr. Gilbert Welch, wrote a book a few years ago called Overdiagnosis. And he essentially said the poster child for overdiagnosis is the prostate, the PSA test. In fact, he said that he estimated that upwards of 2 million American men have been unnecessarily treated for prostate cancer. And you might say, well, maybe you would have saved some of those men's lives. The reality is that you will have caused, for every man's life you might have saved, you will cause hundreds of them to have unnecessary surgery. And that surgery and follow-up treatment often involves impotence and incontinence. And so, as one physician joked with me, he said, with a PSA test, you may not live longer, but your life will feel longer.
Wow, that's unbelievable. And you know, what's so incredible about this is still the number of people, even after listening to an interview like this or reading a book like Seeking Sickness, they would still opt for a lot of these tests and blindly believe in what their doctor is saying, even though the doctor definitely doesn't have all the answers. And that's really what you're trying to do, is you're trying to educate people. You're not really saying, hey, don't ever undergo a test. You're
absolutely.
Saying,
yeah.
There you go. You're absolutely. Saying, understand the options.
Sure. And in fact, you know, even with the PSA test, if you're a man that has it in the family, in terms of your father or brother might have had prostate cancer, you might be at higher risk. You know, there is a chance that you might benefit from having the test. I would never say don't do the test. I would say do the test only with your eyes wide open.
But Alan, when we're talking about a test like the PSA, I mean, even the periodic task force that recommends, you know, what test to take and gives the doctors and the pharmaceutical industry the information out there. I mean, aren't they even saying PSA isn't really that good? I mean, we're learning that there are so many false positives on this PSA that it is actually causing more problems.
Yes, and the committee that you're referring to is what I would consider to be producing the world's gold standard evidence on screening tests. It's called the United States Preventive Services Task Force, USPSTF. And this group are independent scientists and researchers. They sit down and they say, okay, what does the evidence say? As opposed to listening to the testimonials of individuals, what does the big research study say, the good quality evidence, what does it say? And they recently came out with a pronouncement, and this was quite controversial. And I actually predicted this. This came out this year. They said that routine PSA testing should not be done.
Wow.
Point blank. And that really blew the lid off things. And you, part of the reason why it's so controversial, other than you've got lots of people who believe that they or the lives of their fathers or brothers might have been saved by this test, but you've got an awful lot of money in the tests. You've got the urologists whose job it is to treat prostate conditions and prostate cancer. They stand to lose an awful lot of money if the PSA test is done away with. And so they have.
Alan, let's hold it right there, because that's a very, very important point, also a very controversial point. I want to pick it up where we left off. We're going to go to our first break, come back. Let's talk about that. Who really benefits from these tests? Because, you know, many, many people listening would never think that they would be undergoing a test to become yet another moneymaker for an industry. Because, I mean, obviously, the doctor's first oath is to first do no harm. So let's pick it up there. there. You're listening to Transforming Health with Brad King. My guest today is Alan Castles. He is the author of Seeking Sickness. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Are you in pain? Do you want more energy? A stronger immune system? Rarely does nature reveal a therapeutic agent so incredible that medical researchers and the people who try it are astounded by its health-enhancing benefits. Introducing Leaf Source, a mineral product that is derived from a 100% natural, organic, prehistoric seabed deposit. To find out how Leaf Source can help you, visit www.leafsource.com. Did you know that the environment may play an ever-increasing role in a sluggish metabolism, which can lead to reduced energy and weight gain? The good news is that the Ultimate Her Energy and Ultimate Male Energy can help combat these negative effects. Please visit www.awakenyourbody.com to find out how you can once again look, feel, and perform in a youthful manner.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
This is Transforming Health with host Brad King. Our program will open up your youthful energy potential and help you live a disease-free life of abundant energy and vitality. Now, back to the program.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Transforming Health. Incredible show today, obviously because of an incredible guest and an equally incredible topic. You know, according to Discover Magazine, there was a recent poll conducted by the Campaign for Effective Patient Care. It's a nonprofit advocacy group based in California. 65% of the 800 California voters surveyed said that they thought that most or nearly all of the healthcare they receive is based on scientific evidence. The reality would probably shock them. A panel of experts convened in 2007 by the prestigious Institute of Medicine, and they estimated that well below half of the procedures doctors perform and the decisions they make about surgeries, drugs, and even tests have been adequately investigated and shown to be highly effective. Now, the rest are based on combination of guesswork, theory, and tradition with a strong dose of marketing by things like drug companies and device companies. Once again, please welcome back pharmaceutical policy researcher and the best-selling author of Seeking Sickness, Medical Screening, and the Misguided Hunt for Disease. We have with us Alan Castles. Alan, I want to talk a little more about where we left off, and we just happened to get into the subject of one of the most prevalent tests that go out for men, which is the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen test, where if that comes back with a high reading, doctors usually order some type of a biopsy, and then from there, if they find something that looks irregular, the full treatment starts to ensue. Now, you had sent something which is very interesting, and I want you to pick it up from there. You were talking about how if they don't perform the PSA, then they don't get to, you know, dive a little further into what's going wrong with that patient or what could possibly go wrong with that patient, which means there's a whole industry that could actually suffer from that. And before you come on and talk about that a little further, there were a lot of studies on the ineffectiveness of the PSA. We spoke about how some of the organizations that actually make recommendations to the industry and the medical community, they don't even agree with it. But there's a lot of false positive rates, as high as 85% with PSA screenings. And all told, 25 million men in the United States have had prostate biopsies that showed absolutely no evidence of cancer. So let's pick it up from there. If we were to listen to these organizations that make the right recommendations based on the research, and we don't, you know, medical doctors don't undergo more PSA screenings or other screenings, who suffers?
Well, the major players in the prostate world are it's the urology community. So that would be the profession of urology that really, you know, for them, it's a multi-billion-dollar annual income earner as treating prostate cancer. I think a prostate surgeon can get, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for removing a man's prostate. The radiology, oftentimes they'll use types of chemotherapy when they're doing these kinds of procedures. And that kind of radiation treatment can earn a hospital something like $50,000 or $60,000 to radiate one prostate. So you can see the enormous push there is to find prostate cancer. And what they tend to do is to really promote this idea that they're saving people's lives. What would be more accurate to say is that they're saving their own jobs, or they're saving their income for themselves, really. So, my sense is that when you look at the organizations that really promote this, it's not just the urologists and the radiologists, but you have consumer groups as well, men's groups, and those groups are funded largely by the radiology community and the urology community, but they're also funded by drug companies that make treatments for prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. And they have some very unusual groups of partners. One example might be the company called Depends, and this company makes adult diapers. So you say, why would a company that makes adult diapers be supporting PSA screening? Well, guess what? 40 to 50% of the people that undergo prostate treatment are going to be incontinent. They're going to need those diapers. So it seems almost cruel and ironic that you would get that kind of sponsorship, but they're out there as well promoting this kind of message.
Right, and then, I mean, it goes a lot deeper than that. Obviously, you've got the people that make things like the luteinizing hormone, releasing hormone agonists, those estrogen treatments. You get Viagra, Cialis, you know, because yeah. As also there's a very high incidence of erectile dysfunction. So,
absolutely.
You know, it really takes away the livelihood of a man, of what we are defined by and what completes our life. I mean, mm-hmm. all of this is very important to us. You take that away from us and, you know, we're going to suffer. There's going to be a lot of, you know, different types of psychological issues, never mind the physiological issues. Right. So here's an interesting question to you then. When you're talking about all this is a big business. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's in their best interest to also keep away anything that would be so-called natural and effective. And we hear about, you know, all of these natural treatments that are mm-hmm. very effective in some cases against different forms of cancer. Obviously, this would be very much against these establishments. They would not want to, in a sense, from what you're saying, find a cure then. What would be the point? They'd be losing a lot of business.
Absolutely. And you know, so, I mean, there are some cynics out there that say, you know, cancer is a very big business. And if you were able to prevent it, if you were actually able to prevent it, then there's a lot of people that are going to be losing their livelihood. You know, the thing is that people look at screening and they confuse it with prevention. They think that if I get screened for prostate cancer, if I get screened for breast cancer, it's somehow going to prevent it. Well, it doesn't work that way at all. With breast cancer screening, for example, mammography, they may be able to very delicately find very small nodules in a woman's breast and determine that those might be the precursors to cancers that need to be removed. Though they're not preventing cancer, they are finding early signs of it. And a lot of times, certainly with mammography, those early signs are often not anything worth worrying about. You know, one of the most surprising things I found when I was researching this book is that there have been a number of fairly large studies of mammography where some of the women, when they have found breast tumors, they essentially did not give those women any treatment. They went on, but so they treated some of the women, they didn't treat another group of women. And they found that the women who were untreated, a lot of them had their breast cancers disappear. Now you might say, That's absolutely shocking. I've never heard of anything like that. It's quite well documented that what they think that might be cancer is not actually cancer. It might be calcifications. It might be small nodules that never go on to hurt the woman.
So what percentage then would you say, because I've actually seen these reports myself, Alan, and it's so shocking that it's upwards of 50 and maybe even more than 50% of what you're saying, these nodules, these things that are irregular, where they're aggressively treated as advanced breast cancer when, as you said, the majority of them are absolutely nothing. What do you think the percentages are?
Well, you know, it varies depending on which study you look at. But one very interesting statistic, if you ask women about the benefits of mammography, you say to them, what percentage of women do you think will have their lives saved from undergoing, say, an annual mammogram, series of mammograms? And women might say, well, you know, 50% or 30% of women will have their lives saved. The reality is the best quality study, they have to screen 2,000 women every year for 11 years to save one life. And you may say, well, that one life could be my mother or sister. What's wrong with that? Well, of the, you know, of the other 1,999 women who were screened and whose lives weren't saved, about 500 or 600 of those women are going to have false positives found. They're going to have biopsies. Some of them will have mastectomies and other forms of unnecessary surgery and be exposed to chemotherapy and so on. So, you know, yes, you can save a life with mammography. At what cost? And the cost is a huge amount of unnecessary suffering and treatment in the women whose lives would never be saved.
Okay, so there's that. There's the false positives. There's the misdiagnosing what they believe is cancer. I mean, you know, that begs the question then, with all of these numbers that are being presented, you know, millions upon millions, hundreds of thousands of women that are experiencing breast cancer and hundreds of thousands of men that are experiencing breast cancer around North America every year, how many of this is actually cancer when you think about it? Because if a lot of these are just being treated as cancer, they're going to show up in the polls as cancer regardless, are they not?
Yeah, yes. And in fact, you know, it seems to me that the whole definition of cancer is shifting over time. It used to be that, you know, if you had a cancer, that was something that you absolutely needed to be removed. There's no waiting. You have to go in there and you have to do surgery and you have to get rid of it. But nowadays, cancer is more dealt with as almost like a chronic condition where, yes, you can do some treatment, but sometimes leaving it alone might be the right thing to do. One of the things that I need to remind listeners of is that when they look at sort of the benefits of screening, say, over the last 10 years, they will say the breast cancer death rate has dropped. And it's true. Over about the last 10 or 15 years, the rate of breast cancer death has dropped by about 25%. And you would say, well, that's clearly a benefit of screening. To which I would say, well, when you actually look at the benefits of screening, the benefits are not 25%. You haven't dropped the death rate of breast cancer by 25%. What has caused their death rate to go down has been other things. It's been better treatments. So women who do get breast cancer are living longer. And the other main thing that most people might forget about is that 10 years ago, women were routinely prescribed hormone replacement therapy for hot flashes and for symptoms of menopause. And they're also told these drugs will protect you from having a heart attack.
Right.
It wasn't until they did a large quality study and found that actually more women were suffering from heart attacks and breast cancers when they were taking estrogen, that women stopped doing that en masse. So
right.
One of the major reasons why we're seeing death rates drop from breast cancer is because a lot fewer women are taking hormone replacement therapy.
And, you know, I think it's very important to also interject the fact that this estrogen replacement therapy and progesterone replacement therapy was 100% synthetic. I mean, you're talking about something that was manufactured from horse's urine and many estrogens that are not even part of our biology. So
Absolutely. There's
a whole new class which are bioidentical, the same molecular structure as what appears in our body. We don't, unfortunately, have enough research on that. But, hey, if something is as close close or the same as what is produced in the body, you know, common sense would dictate it's not going to cause nearly as much damage, and there might be a lot more benefits to how it's balancing the body. We're going to go out to a break, come back for the second half of Transforming Health, and I want to talk a little more about mammography, because there's still a lot of women that, once again, blindly, year after year, you know, they go in for the mammography test, and they have no idea of the risk factors of what is behind mammography. And I'm not even talking about what Alan Castles was just mentioning about, you know, the possibility of being treated for something that isn't even cancer. I'm talking about, what if a test that you believed in was actually causing something like cancer? Let's talk about that next on Transforming Health with Brad King. Don't go anywhere.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Did you know that the environment may play an ever-increasing role in a sluggish metabolism, which can lead to reduced energy and weight gain? The good news is that the Ultimate Her Energy and Ultimate Male Energy can help combat these negative effects. Please visit www.awakenyourbody.com to find out how you can once again look, feel, and perform in a youthful manner. Are you in pain? Do you want more energy? A stronger immune system? Rarely does nature reveal a therapeutic agent so incredible that medical researchers and the people who try it are astounded by its health-enhancing benefits. Introducing Leaf Source, a mineral product that is derived from a 100% natural, organic, prehistoric seabed deposit. To find out how Leaf Source can help you, visit www.leafsource.com.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
This is Transforming Health with host Brad King. Our program will open up your youthful energy potential and help you live a disease-free life of abundant energy and vitality. Now, back to the program.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the second half of Transforming Health. You know, we live in this world where almost every other person seems to be sick, or at least well on their way to becoming sick. And we all know people who have experienced the devastation of chronic illness like heart disease and cancer. So, you know, why wouldn't you want to be screened to see if you're at risk for these diseases, things like cancer, heart disease, or another potentially lethal condition? I mean, after all, aren't we better safe than sorry? Well, today's guest says, not so fast. The world of medical screening is run by well-meaning practitioners and a profit-motivated industry, all of which offer to save our lives by exploiting our fears. Promoters of medical screening overpromise on its benefits and downplay its harms, which can range from the merely annoying to the life-threatening. If you're facing a screening test for things like breast or prostate cancer, high cholesterol, who isn't screened for high cholesterol, or hormone issues, someone's end goal is to turn you into a patient. You have to realize this. So before embarking on one of those so-called just-to-be-safe medical tests, you need to ask yourself one simple question. Am I ready for all the things that could go wrong? Today's guest is a pharmaceutical policy researcher at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, Canada. He studies how clinical research information and experience on prescription drugs get communicated to policymakers and consumers alike. Once again, please welcome the best-selling author of Seeking Sickness, Medical Screening, and the Misguided Hunt for Disease. We have with us Alan Castles. Alan, we were talking about things like the PSA and prostate cancer and what a massive industry it is for the urologists and everyone else that could benefit from it, the pharmaceutical companies. You know, you were mentioning it's extremely, it brings in a great deal of money to this industry, but you didn't mention how much. And You know, I don't know if you agree with this, and maybe you have these stats somewhere, but I actually did interview someone who had looked into the research of what the average cancer patient means to the cancer industry, the doctors, the hospitals, the pharmaceutical, all the way down the road. And it's between $750,000 to $1 million per person all the way through treatment. Now this is according to his research. We were talking about mammographies. I'm going to let you, touch on that as well. But we were talking about mammographies before we went out to the last break, and we were talking about how many, once again, false positives, and how many women may be treated for aggressive breast cancer when in fact it's not cancer at all. But there's a lot of skepticism now, more and more, on how beneficial this test is, not to mention the possible dangers. What about the radiation from these tests that women are exposed to? Could this be in effect causing the cancer?
Well, absolutely. In fact, there is a the perhaps not with the x-rays they use so much in mammography testing, but when they do full body scans, and that's another area of screening that I look closely at, when they do full body scans using CT, these are computed tomography scanners, these scanners can deliver the equivalent of something like 400 to 500 chest x-rays throughout your entire body. And you might say, well, isn't it worth it if those that scan finds something that's going to save my life? You'd say, well, the likelihood of that is very small, and the likelihood of you actually causing cancer by exposing yourself to that much radiation is high. I mean, it's not high in the sense of, but the more screening that you get, the more exposure to radiation, your body remembers it, and the more likely you're going to develop cancer. In fact, there was a study that was reported in the New York Times, I think about 2 years ago, that showed statistically in the United States, something like 2% of cancers are probably caused by excessive use of CT scanners. You know, 2% of cancers, that's a huge amount of disease that we're causing by, you know, inappropriate screening, inappropriate use of these tools. You know, if you got a good tool, you want to use it when you need it, but like any tool, you don't want to overuse it. You don't want to treat every nail as something that needs to be hammered down. And, you know, so, you know, one of the things that I say to people and that I refer to in the book, Seeking Sickness, is that if you're going to be screened for something, you might have to ask yourself, is there a potential to be not helped and to be harmed by the actual act of screening? And I can, you know, I gave a number of examples of how you can be harmed by that. But what, you know, the other thing that I wanted to sort of really point out is that the screening that we're talking about is something like, you know, PSA testing or mammography testing, is screening that's typically offered by doctors. It's been very well studied, but there are huge numbers of screening tests that are offered everywhere and simply don't have the research to back them up. And probably the best example, and this is actually kind of a humorous example, is the kind of thing that I would call self-screening, where you will often see, say, in a magazine or a newspaper or even in an internet ad, it'll ask some questions. It'll say things like, for example, are you sometimes distracted? Do you sometimes lose your train of thought? Do you sometimes forget where you're going and not able to finish your sentence? And then, so you get six questions of this type, and you answer yes to two or three of them, and the punchline is, you might have adult attention deficit disorder. You should see your doctor. These kinds of screening tests, by the way, they are throughout the internet. They're very popularly used in magazines and so on. And it's about getting people to start thinking of whatever they've got in a medical way. And in my opinion, they should absolutely be avoided, because when you talk about mental health screening and doing questionnaires that make you start thinking about yourself as having some mental health condition, everything can go wrong in that situation.
I want to talk about this a little more, because when you talk about different types of mental or cognitive disorders, there's a whole class of drugs, which is the number one prescription drug category now in the world, which is the statin medications to lower or to block cholesterol production in the body. Now there's newer research showing that these statins are probably affecting brain function, because people don't realize how important cholesterol is to brain function. So let's talk about cholesterol, because I bet you we all know someone or ourselves are on these this class of medications. So in your opinion, and from the research you present in your book, Seeking Sickness, what are the risks that are associated with testing for cholesterol?
Well, firstly, I would say, you know, point blank, that most people who are otherwise healthy and don't have established heart disease will not benefit from having their cholesterol altered. I would never get my cholesterol tested, because I know that even if my cholesterol is high, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to increase my risk of having a heart attack or stroke. See, cholesterol levels are a risk factor for a future disease, but we treat them as a disease in and of themselves. And people become, you know, obsessed with their cholesterol numbers. Their doctor will say, well, I've sent you for a blood test. Your cholesterol level is high. You know, your LDL should be lower. Your HDL should be higher, and so on. And they will convince people that they need to be altering their diet or altering their cholesterol levels with drugs. And I can tell you, I've looked at the big meta-analyses. These are the big studies of the cholesterol-lowering drugs. And most people would be shocked to know that the numbers of people that actually benefit, and when I talk about benefit, I'm talking about real benefit. So prevention of a heart attack, prevention of a stroke. The actual numbers of people that actually benefit from cholesterol-lowering drugs is very small. You know, less than, say, 2 or 3% of people would benefit. The vast majority of people who take cholesterol-lowering drugs would be older people, say the elderly or women, and there is no proven benefit in those populations. Yet, at least probably half the population of statin users in the United States are women. And, you know, I will often have women say to me, you know, I'm really concerned about my cholesterol level, and I'm doing what I can, but the cholesterol drug doesn't seem to be helping. And I'll say, well, what kind of side effects are you experiencing? And they'll say, well, I'm feeling kind of weak. I've got weak muscles. Perhaps I'm not thinking as clearly as I could be. And I'll say, absolutely, those are the effects, the adverse effects associated with statins. And so even getting a cholesterol test, if it leads you down the road where you get a drug that you don't need and a drug which causes side effects such as muscle weakening and cognitive dysfunction, you're being harmed by not just the drug, but you have been harmed by the screening test.
Absolutely. And here's the thing, you know, and I want to talk about this a little more, because there's almost, I get so many emails from, you know, men and women that are on these statin medications. They're doing exactly what you just mentioned, losing muscle tissue. So many men complain about lost libido and erectile dysfunction. It's probably one of the top side effects for statin medications, memory problems. Now we're hearing about research linking statins to things like Alzheimer's and possibly Parkinson's disease. So talk a little bit more about the problems associated with these, because we're in this society where we don't really understand something. We're believing in our doctor. The doctor says, here, go here. You have a high level of something that could potentially cause heart disease. We haven't done our homework. We believe him. But at what cost are we potentially stopping heart disease? Is that for so we can have the entire body break down? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you know, I absolutely think that cholesterol screening is probably the most controversial area that I touch on this in this book, because so many people have been, you know, it's a routine thing that physicians do. Even the experts are saying you should be checking people's cholesterol levels. And I really question that strongly, because my question was, how many people are benefiting? How many heart attacks, how many strokes are we preventing from giving people cholesterol-lowering drugs? And, you know, one thing that that happens in this field, because it is so lucrative, all of the major cholesterol drug trials have been funded by the manufacturers. And there's strong levels of bias in those studies. So you've got the manufacturer who has its cholesterol-lowering drug, wants it to compete with the competitor, shows some benefit in a certain population, and then markets the heck out of it to that population. And a good example would be this, probably the most recent, one of the most recent cholesterol-lowering drugs, a drug called Crestor or rosuvastatin. It went through a trial called the Jupiter trial that they gave to people who had C-reactive protein, a high level of C-reactive protein, plus high cholesterol, and they found a small benefit. But they had to study literally 50,000 people in order to show any kind of benefit. And I can tell you, when they've got a study where they need more than 10,000 people to show any benefit, the actual benefit to the individual person is going to be very small.
Yeah, they're reaching at that point. What's interesting about what you said is C-reactive protein is more of a risk factor than cholesterol ever was, because mm-hmm. we now know that heart disease is directly linked to inflammation, and C-reactive protein is a measurement of inflammation in the body as well. We're going to go out to our final break. We're going to come back with the final segment with Alan Castles and his book Seeking Sickness. And I'm going to ask Alan about these bone scans, because I am sick and tired of talking to women about osteoporosis and osteopenia and them going on this class of drugs called bisphosphonates and them not understanding the serious side effects associated with them. And even worse, what if these didn't even work and they actually only caused problems? Let's find out about that when we come back, and then we're going to find out as much more about seeking sickness as we can. We'll be right back.
Learn more. Live better. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Are you in pain? Do you want more energy? A stronger immune system? Rarely does nature reveal a therapeutic agent so incredible that medical researchers and the people who try it are astounded by its health-enhancing benefits. Introducing Leaf Source, a mineral product that is derived from a 100% natural, organic, prehistoric seabed deposit. To find out how Leaf Source can help you, visit www.leafsource.com. Did you know that the environment may play an ever-increasing role in a sluggish metabolism, which can lead to reduced energy and weight gain? The good news is that the Ultimate Her Energy and Ultimate Male Energy can help combat these negative effects. Please visit www.awakenyourbody.com. to find out how you can once again look, feel, and perform in a youthful manner.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
This is Transforming Health with host Brad King. Our program will open up your youthful energy potential and help you live a disease-free life of abundant energy and vitality. Now, back to the program.
Hey, how many of you remember when your mother would take you to the hospital for x-rays almost every time you fell? I mean, I certainly remember. Have you ever stopped to think about all the damage you could be causing every time you undergo one of those so-called benign scans? I mean, all that unneeded care can be hazardous to your health. And for example, x-rays and CT scans expose you to potentially cancer-causing radiation, could lead to follow-up tests and treatments with additional risks. And the cost can be substantial. There was a 2011 study that found that the price tag for 12 commonly overused tests, such as an annual electrocardiogram for heart disease and imaging tests for lower back pain, was about $7 billion. Please welcome back pharmaceutical policy researcher and the best-selling author of Seeking Sickness, Medical Screening, and the Misguided Hunt for Disease, Alan Castles. Alan, you know, we spoke about a lot of these various tests and procedures. We went through the PSA, we went through prostate cancer, mammograms, and the dangers of, the false positives and women being treated for things that aren't even cancer, and then the potential problems associated with exposing a woman to extra radiation that could be creating or at least becoming part of the problem of cancer. And we spoke about cholesterol and cholesterol-lowering drugs. Let's talk about another massive area, bone density scans for low-risk women. What's your take on this?
Well, my take is that I think that bone density testing is one of the biggest, and I don't use this lightly, I think it's one of the biggest scams going. And, you know, of course, your listeners are going to freak out when I say that. But let me tell you, I've been looking at osteoporosis and osteoporosis screening for about 18 years now, right from the early days when the first major osteoporosis drug was launched. This is a drug called Fosamax or Alendronate, produced by Merck and launched in 1996. You know, what was very clear at the beginning, and I've actually interviewed people who were involved in the PR campaign and the marketing campaign around Fosamax, is that in order to sell that drug, they needed to be able to identify women who had low bone density. And the very definition was created at a World Health Organization meeting in the mid-90s, and the people who sat around the table to define that condition, a number of them had ties to pharmaceutical manufacturers. So the companies themselves were putting their own people on the committee to define the disease. And in fact, shockingly, they defined it in a way that 50% of women who reach the age of 65 years old are going to have this condition. So just by definition, you are medicalizing what is what I would consider to be a normal part of aging, which is as you get older and you're a woman, your bones lose their density. So you might say, well, shouldn't you do what you can to increase bone density, including getting tests and taking drugs? And I would say, absolutely, you should do that if the drugs actually worked, if the tests actually led you to achieve better health. But, you know, some of the things that most people don't know is that the main thing that you want to avoid is a broken hip. The question is, do women who have osteoporosis, as it's defined, are they more likely to break a hip than women who have normal bone density? And in fact, when they've done the big studies and looked at this, having osteoporosis is a risk factor, but it's a very small risk factor. The bigger risk factor, whether you're going to have a broken hip or not, is whether you're taking sleeping pills, whether you have loose rugs in your house, whether you're frail because you don't get enough exercise and your muscles aren't strong enough. So there's a whole range of things that can contribute to hip fractures. The density of your bones being a very small factor, though we focus on it, when I say we, the medical system focuses on it because we can develop a test for it and we can prescribe drugs for it. And the osteoporosis, I'll call it the osteoporosis industry, went from being virtually non-existent in the mid-90s to now being a multi-billion dollar a year industry which sells the bone density test and the drugs that treat alleged low bone density.
So let's discuss that a little more, because the research shows that if you have – you're a woman, you go in for one of these DEXA scans, let's say, you have only mild bone loss, so we know that as osteopenia, that's not osteoporosis. The risk fracture is very, very low for women that have osteopenia. It's almost the same as women who don't supposedly have osteopenia. But the ones that, let's say they do have osteopenia, some doctors are still going to say, oh, well, we better be safe than sorry. Let's put you on this class of drugs. Let's put you on something like Fosamax or Boniva or something like that. What are the risks of going on those drugs? Because obviously, if you're going to go on a drug, I mean, you know, we have these commercials that are a minute long for a reason to the pharmaceutical community. You have 30 seconds of people jumping in daisies and holding hands, and then 30 seconds of, you know, you could die, basically. So,
well, you know,
tell us about these.
Absolutely. I started off my chapter on osteoporosis testing by talking about the bad news that's arriving at the doorstep of the drug manufacturers, because these drugs are still relatively new. I say they're, you know, 15, 16 years old. They're starting to discover that women who are taking bisphosphonates, so these are drugs like Actonel or Fosamax, they take these drugs long enough, and it actually increases the brittleness of their bones. So,
right.
You know, it's cruel and ironic that you've got a drug that supposedly is going to prevent you from having fractures, but actually can increase your risk of having a thigh bone fracture, and in some cases, a hip fracture. So you're not actually having any net health benefit. As well, the drugs are extremely caustic to the gastrointestinal tract, and in fact, they're very difficult to take, and they can cause burning and nausea and vomiting and so on. So they're very difficult drugs to take. And wouldn't it be a shame if you are convincing women to take these highly caustic drugs, telling them that they're going to prevent a bone fracture, when in fact you're probably not stopping any rates of bone fractures, but you're increasing the risk of having adverse effects?
You know, there was a story in the news, you're probably aware of this, of a lady that was on one of these same class of drugs, and she was I think she was on it for 7 years, and that is way too long to be on a drug like that. And she was on a subway, mm-hmm. and literally the subway just came to one of those abrupt stops, and she was holding on. She literally snapped her femur,
yes.
just from basically coming. That's how brittle her bones are. Now,
well,
that's
yes,
not...
I mean, that's an anecdotal report, but there's actually an FDA warning of that very occurrence, where taking the bisphosphonate drug will increase your risk of having that kind of what they call spontaneous femur fracture.
Right, and what about necrosis of the jaw? I mean, could you imagine your grandmother where her jaw starts to waste away? This is happening with people on these drugs.
Yes, yeah. In fact, the jaw deterioration issue is, and you talk to any dentist nowadays, one of the questions that they're going to ask any of their female older patients is, are you taking an osteoporosis drug? And I've heard anecdotally, at least from dentists, that they won't treat women that have been taking these drugs, because any kind of oral surgery, and you can cause serious problems when the jaw starts to crumble.
Alan, listen, we're almost out of time here. I want people to really go out and get your book and read your book. I mean, a lot of people have these health books, but they don't really read them. Mm-hmm. This, in my opinion, is one of the most important books for people to really understand and read, because it can save lives. The book is called Seeking Sickness. My guest today has been Alan Castles. Alan, how can people get information on you and also the book Seeking Sickness?
Well, you could Google Seeking Sickness. You'll find me, and you'll find my website. And my website is just my name, alancastles.com. And, you know, I post a lot of the articles and the other journalistic stuff that I do. My contact information is on my website as well, if you need to send me an email or phone me.
And Ellen, I'm going to give you a really good compliment before I let you go here. And how I heard about you is, I was at a very good friend of mine. I was at his house in Squamish. He's actually a medical doctor, and he's the one who told me about you. So here's a conventionally trained guy. We started talking about all the problems with pharmaceuticals, and he actually said, "Hey, you got to look into some of the stuff this Alan Castles guy does. It's really interesting." And then I got a hold of your publicist. So yeah. I want to thank you for being you, for doing what you do to spread this news. It's very important. You are a great guest, and I'm now a fan, so thank you very much, Alan.
Thanks for having me. I'd love to do it again.
Absolutely. I want to thank everyone for listening to the show today. We'll be back next week, same time, same place, and I guarantee you, another incredible guest. Go out and have yourself a fantastic week. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Transforming Health with Brad King. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Looking forward to next week. Now, with your newfound energy, go out and make it work for you.